Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Many, many people are uncomfortable, deeply uncomfortable, talking about death. But procrastinating to get your will done is only going to lead to more stress down the road. Elaine Fraze is a farm family transition expert. Get this, she already has her casket. Literally, it's in her basement. I've seen pictures of it. And she is here to tell us what is preventing people from creating their will and how they can get over themselves and get started to get it done. Then, have you ever wondered what happens to your debt after you die? What if you've co-signed a loan? What if you've got a supplementary credit card? All those kinds of questions. Credit Canada's financial coaching manager, Becky Western McFadden, is going to be here to talk about the implications if your loved one were to pass with debt on the books or if it were to be you. And it is so easy to buy stuff these days, really, like super, super easy. Cash is going the way of the VCR, but what's coming in to replace it? Sandra Myers is the country manager for Canada for the payments company Adyen. He's here to talk about the future of payments. Plus, I'll speak to financial activist, money mentor, educator, TikToker, Priceless Tay. Her real name's Taylor Price, and she's really focused on how to make a difference for Gen Z and financial literacy. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Estate planning can be really complex, both the actual task and the emotional dynamics that surround it. For farm families, it's often more so because there's a business involved and because the emotional ties to that business and to the land can be very, very strong. Elaine Fraze is a farm family transition expert. She has walked this path many, many times with her clients and has some, what she calls, easy ways to help you get your will done. We reached her on her farm near Boisvane, Manitoba. Hello there.
Great to see you, Bruce.
You have a storage container in your basement that is actually the casket you plan to use for your own funeral. I saw in your YouTube video, you called it Grandma's Jesus Box. How did that come to be? And that is the best thing I've ever heard in my life.
Well, it's all how you frame things, right? It's what mindset you have. So the story of the box is I had a dear friend, Ed, who died of cancer. And his last weekend on earth, his wife called and said, would you and Wes please come and just spend the weekend with us and take him back to the hospital, which we did as close friends. And it was a very special privilege to spend his last days with him. And then at his funeral, this beautiful whitewashed pine box appeared. But further to that, his grandchildren had also painted on the outside of it, Bruce, as part of their grieving process and saying goodbye to Grandpa. It was crafted by a local craftsman here from Boisvane, Manitoba. His name's Sheldon Dick. I paid $2,200 to have mine built. And quite frankly, I built it as a very expensive speaking prop initially. And then when I started telling people about it, they said, oh, Elaine, I know a woman who did that and let her grandchildren climb it and put their storage toys in it. And she wanted them to get familiar with her casket so that when she passed, they would know that she had gone to meet Jesus in heaven. And it was okay because it was her Jesus box. So that's how that all came together. And it is, I have not let my grandchildren climb inside yet. I haven't asked their mom's permission. My grandchildren live 159 steps from my back door. But the point being, Bruce, is we all are going to die and we need to be prepared. And I think I also made a great investment because I think the price of my casket has now gone up.
Very smart. It's a twofer. Now, you and I are in the minority in that we are comfortable talking about death, talking about estate planning. What would you say made you comfortable talking about this in the first place? Was it always thus, or was there an evolution for you?
I think it's always been for me. I'm the oldest of five children. I grew up with a very direct mother of Irish descent, and I have had a lot of loss in my life, Bruce. So I buried my sister when she was 23 at the hands of a drunk driver. She died on the way back from my farm here in Boisvane back to Dugald, which is where I grew up, close to Winnipeg. I buried my mom at 65 of an asthma attack in the middle of harvest, which was a stress-induced disease, I think, because of the death of my sister. I had buried my father-in-law 10 months previous of a brain shrinking disease. And I've just had a lot of loss in my life that I've had to, and I've also got my certificate in palliative care. And because of my worldview as a Jesus follower, I don't see death as a bad thing because I have the hope of heaven. So in farm families, though, when we talk about death and coming to terms, people say, well, I'm just going to die and let my kids figure it out. And the reason I love your Moolah La podcast so much is because you're always encouraging people to grab the bull by the horns and face the hard things. And I think that's maybe you and I have learned that in our journey. You and I are both adoptive parents. So I've also faced the loss of secondary infertility and, you know, just all these different losses. And so loss is not a bad thing, I don't think, if you learn from it. And how do you want to craft something better and create a better future hope for your family?
I'm the youngest of five, but also raised by a very strong mom. And I want to segue to some of the tips that you have to help people get started. And as a farm person, farm family expert, I love that your first tip is so darn practical, and it is time in your calendar. So we'll talk about the emotional stuff and we'll get into all that. But you say, first and foremost, you need to put it in your calendar.
And that's how I'm living now. You can hear my phone dinging because people are messaging me. We're in the middle of our plant. So we're halfway to planting 5,000 acres. But my life is very full, Bruce, and I hate the word busy. So I say, yes, my life is full. But if I can put a 25-minute reminder on my phone, which in Italian is a Pomodoro, it's a kitchen timer. It's also called the Pomodoro technique. You can get a lot done in 25 minutes. And so I had my sister here recently, and I'm her executor of her estate. And we went through all her documents. We put everything into a digital folder, and then I have it, she has it, and then she also has her physical folder. And so blocking time on your Google Calendar is one of my most practical tips. Is this is the time I'm going to do that. And if you need a reward, give yourself a reward. But the reward will feel, it will be lightness. It'll be knowing that you've got your affairs in better order than they were yesterday.
You also acknowledge that there is some thinking required here. What are some of the big questions for people to think through?
First is how, in terms of thinking, I think you want to understand the organization of, say, your power of attorney and your will. So a will is not a succession plan. And much of the work I do is around transition and passing on, changing labor management and ownership of a business, which is a farm business. But on the will side, power of attorney is really important. And my husband has had three accidents in his pickup truck. He's a very good driver, but stuff happens when you've been farming for over 40 years. So we traveled to New Zealand to see my friend who's a farm family coach in New Zealand, spent a month in New Zealand. And we thought, you know, if we're driving on the wrong side of the road, we better have a power of attorney in case something happens to us while we're traveling. And so my son had that, and little did he know that he would have to invoke it when my husband had a very bad crash in 2017. So what you have to think about is what if. And so for people listening to this, what if somebody in your household does not die, but becomes incapacitated? And so that was very helpful for us to have in place. The other thing you have to think about is, who do you want to manage your estate? And I'm the oldest of five, as we mentioned. But I also, when I discovered what my father's will said, he had my two siblings who lived in BC at the time as executors. And my brother and I, my farming brother and I said, no, Dad, this is just way too complicated with out of province people. So he made a change and I became the sole executor because I had a good working relationship with my farming brother. And I also had an excellent lawyer. The other thing, Bruce, in terms of thinking, is my father's thinking was changing and he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And so as I saw that happening, I was able to consolidate all of his finances to one credit union. I was able to get all of his doctor's addresses, phone numbers, emails, et cetera, so that when I had to execute the death certificate or tell people that my father had passed, it was all done. And I didn't find that weird. I just found that practical, like get yourself organized.
There is an additional challenge for farm families given the asset. The land is a huge, huge asset for farm families. How do families navigate that when there are a number of kids and maybe only one who is going to take on the farm?
They don't.
They don't navigate it.
It's
because, and then after the fact, they call you for coaching, hopefully, in the best case. No,
or they're calling me as mom. I just got an email this week. Hello, Elaine. My mom is 94. I have two siblings that live in Calgary. I'm the farming daughter. Dun, 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 dun. And I have a saying now, Bruce, I use quite often. That was then, this is now. So in our own scenario, I mentioned my father-in-law dying 10 months before my mom, and that was in October of 97. But in June of 1992, Wes and I purchased this farm from his parents, and his mom had purchased it from her dad in 1945. So we have a matriarchal farm system here, which is fine. But my mother-in-law was raised by a wicked stepmother, really not nice person. And so she had a very high value for fairness and for the women to also be considered. And so when she sold the farm to us with her husband, she made sure that the three non-farming sisters all got a quarter section of land. But in 1992, Bruce, that was $67,000. I'm looking out my front office window right now at my neighbor's quarter section of land, which he would love to sell to me someday, maybe or maybe not, for $500,000 or $440,000. So the question now we have in farm transition is, what does fairness look like to you? And so I never use the word equal because equal is no longer workable in division of assets. And so the word I use now is, what do you expect from us for an inheritance? And secondly, what do you need from us as parents to be successful? And I have parents that are horrified by that question, Bruce, because they'll say, well, it's none of my kids' business. I can do whatever I want with my assets. Well, yes, you can. And you can also create huge estrangement and family fragmentation by not explaining why you've made the decisions you've made, because a farm business needs access to land and ultimately equity in land in order to leverage debt. And that's the conversation that is totally different now than it was in 1992.
You used a phrase in a prior conversation we had, reflecting on the need or the interest or the want of many farmers to die in the dirt. That is a very different dynamic than the person who has a job as an educator, retires at a certain stage, and receives a defined benefit pension plan for the next couple of decades of their life. How does that need manifest when it comes to this question about estate planning?
So many different ways, but let's focus on the land because that's the big bull, what I call the undiscussable bull in the middle of the room. So my husband is 66. He had this crash. He still works many long hours during the busy times. But my friend Dick Whitman, who's a farm family consultant out of Idaho, has this great saying, and you can Google it and find his seminar. I would encourage listeners to do that. It's called Stepping Back Without Stepping Away. Because of the emotional attachment to land, farmers don't want to leave their land typically, but they are going to age in place on the farm. So really the question now becomes, Dad, Mom, what does a good day on this farm look like as you age in place? And a lot of farm families and farmers, Bruce, quite frankly, don't know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. What do you want? Mom very quickly says, I don't want to live at Grand Central Station anymore. And then as a coach, I say, okay, she's given you her best 47 years. When is it her turn to get what she wants? And the guy just says, oh, Elaine, you're so fired. And people think that's a joke, but that actually happened once. Right. Yeah. I asked that to a 72-year-old because his wife was just more than ready to transition to a new chapter. All of this being said, Dad and Mom can have a healthy role on the farm as they age in place, but there have to be clarity of expectation of those roles. And the other thing, Bruce, because you're the money guy with Moolala, is I want listeners just to look at a left-hand side. Just say a ledger, draw a line down the middle of your page. The left-hand side is all of your farm assets or business wealth, even if you're a tire shop guy listening to this. So all your business assets are on the left-hand side. That's awesome. Do you have a successor for your business? Yes, my daughter. Yes, my son. Yes, my next door neighbor. We're going into a joint venture of non-related parties. All good. But then you want to look on the right side, which is where you come in with the book, Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money, because that's what farmers are not being smart about, is they're not being, they don't have those defined pensions. So why don't they pay more attention on how they can get liquidity of income stream, not totally from the farm, but also from their personal wealth? And so in my case, I get $40,000 a year income from my farm, from the personal land that Wes and I own, that is a benefit to me because I rent it back to the Farm Corp. And when I say this to farmers, they go, well, I expect my daughter or my son to buy me out. I go, sure, $2 million they can. And 4% of 2 million is 80 grand. Can you live on 80 grand a year? No, I want 140 more, or I want 120 grand. Well, then there's a $40,000 gap, right, between what you want to live on and where your income stream is going to be based. So my map for family transition is really easy. Number one, what are your income streams going to be and where are they coming from? Number two, where are you going to live? Bruce, I got to stay in my house. I didn't have to move in 2020 as we planned. Yes. So I saved $500,000 because I didn't have to build a new house. My son did. And they're right across the shelter belt in a beautiful, new, very contemporary house, which people have different varying opinions on because it doesn't look like your typical house from the perks. And then thirdly, what we've already touched on, which, what does fairness look like to you? And what do you need to be successful? Because again, Bruce, where is it written? I have always been wealthier than my parents, and so has my property development brother. So he and I did not need anything from our parents' estate financially. What we needed was the emotional blessing of our parents.
So much to talk about, Elaine. I appreciate you joining us to get started.
Thanks, and I hope we can talk again.
Yes, please. Elaine Fraze was here to talk about your wills, the importance for every single Canadian, but in particular, her focus on farm families. Coming up next on Moolala, a related topic. Do you know what happens to your debt after you die? We're going to talk about debt inheritance in Canada. Credit Canada financial coaching manager Becky Western McFadden will be here. And later, Taylor Price, also known as Priceless Tay, will be here to talk about financial literacy for Gen Z. She's a massive star on that thing called TikTok. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can go to moolala.ca to listen to past episodes there, either by full episode or by particular segment. So you can search by name, by topic, or go back to any of the podcast platforms that you listen to podcasts on: Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, Apple Music, wherever else you listen to podcasts. Download the show, write a review, and even subscribe.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Dealing with debt in life is really, really tough. But what about after death? If you lose a parent or a partner, is their debt now yours and vice versa? What would the burden of your debt be on the people that you leave behind in the event of your death? To talk about what you need to know when it comes to debt inheritance in Canada, we're joined by Becky Western McFadden. She is the financial coaching manager at Credit Canada. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me here today.
It's a big question. Can I inherit debt after someone else's death? Can it become part of what I owe?
It is a concerning question. So the short answer is no, but with some exceptions. So the debts of your loved ones do not automatically transfer to you when they pass away, nor would your debts transfer to someone else if you pass away. However, when someone passes away, their estate becomes responsible for paying their debts.
Right. And so what does that mean?
Yeah, because this can be pretty confusing. So a person's debts must be paid out before any inheritance proceeds are paid to their beneficiaries. So inheritance proceeds or an estate can include things like a home with equity, savings, investments, and life insurance without a named beneficiary.
So if that's the black and white, there can be some gray here, like in the case where you may have a family credit card with a secondary card holder, or you've co-signed something. What happens in those two circumstances?
Yes, and those are two different circumstances. So if you're a co-signer on a joint debt and the other person passes away, you become 100% responsible for the debt. Just, you know, as you were legally responsible for the debt while the borrower was alive, you remain responsible for the debt even if they pass away. However, for a supplementary or a secondary card holder, that's different. They're not responsible for the primary card holder's account.
Phew. And you have seen this in your work as a credit counselor. How did this unfold?
So there's the scenario when the primary cardholder passes away and the creditors are notified, those accounts are canceled, you know, the problem solved, it's done, it's taken care of. But if the supplementary cardholder continues to use that credit card after the primary cardholder passes away, then they are responsible for the account.
Okay, so that's an important flag for people to be aware of if circumstances change.
Yes, I actually had a client, Marjorie, that had a supplementary card of her husband's account. So when that husband passed away, she continued to use the card. She didn't tell the bank that he had passed. So when she began to struggle to pay for that account, a collector contacted her for payment. And in this case, the collector was within their rights as Marjorie had to continue to use that card after the husband's death.
There are so many things that someone has to deal with after losing a loved one, but I can imagine some of the worst calls that you could ever receive would be from collection agencies. How does that work? How does that go if you are on the receiving end of those calls?
If there's no estate, you do not need to pay the debt, but do be aware of those collectors, right? So creditors know that debts are uncollectible when there is no estate. However, they may try to convince you otherwise. They'll maybe even threaten to take you to court.
That'd be really upsetting for people, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes, it's a very big concern. So, you know, debt collectors, you know, they'll do their best to try to convince the survivor that they're responsible for the debt, even say it's their legal responsibility, but it's simply not true.
So that's what happens if this were to unfold. You've got some ideas on preventative measures. First off, with the idea of co-signing, start with don't, if you can possibly avoid it.
Yes, if you can possibly avoid it, the first thing is do not co-sign or take on joint debt, simply so that you don't have that problem to start with. Secondly, you could beware of those supplementary cards just to avoid collectors from trying to collect from that person or from your beneficiaries. You'd also want to avoid becoming a guarantor. So don't be a guarantor for someone else's credit cards, because that creates the same issue as a joint credit card holder. And also consider a term life insurance policy, just simply to cover any outstanding debts that may be left behind.
Right. So this is basically a life insurance policy. You pay a monthly fee, and in the event of your death, it has a cash payout. Simple as that.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. You are a big believer in having conversations about money. What does that look like when there is debt in the picture?
I am a huge believer around conversations. So no surprise, my number one piece of advice is talk about it. Talk with your parents or loved one about debt after death. Make sure that there's no unresolved issues. Make sure everyone knows what the debts are and what the plan is should someone pass away. Secondly, I would suggest to create a will to prevent intestacy. So that's just to make sure that the beneficiaries get the proceeds you want them to have. You don't want to enact your province's laws of intestacy. So those are the rules that apply if you die without a will. And the third thing I'd suggest is give out to the inheritors before death. This way, you know, you'll make sure that everyone gets what you want them to have, and you get to see them reap the benefits of that while you're still alive.
If you were the one living, you also have some ideas on things you can do to avoid some challenges in the event of a loved one passing away. This picks up on the idea you had about the supplemental credit card. You'd recommend people send the death certificate to creditors.
Correct. So I would suggest doing so, because if there's any debt behind and there's no assets, it's a quick resolution to that concern. So if you just send the death certificate to the creditors, they can purge it off their books. It's done. It's over with. You don't have to worry about that anymore.
And there may be debts to settle, as you say, as a part of the estate. How do you try and get ahead of that?
You can set up some beneficiary money ahead of time to pay those outstanding bills, almost like a slush fund. So that way, if there's any debts left behind, or there's an estate and any assets, and a creditor wants to make a claim against that estate to recoup money owed, there's money there to just flow through to pay those bills at least temporarily, so that you're not dipping into your own personal finances to set that up.
There is an entire field of law that focuses on estate planning. What sort of questions should people be asking of the professionals?
They want to make sure that they're going to be protected. They're going to want to check where any life insurance policies are going to be directed. So you want to make sure there's named beneficiaries so that it goes to the beneficiary and not the creditors. And so it is a good idea to just get advice from professionals or a lawyer to protect yourself.
Becky, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me here today.
Becky Western McFadden is the financial coaching manager at Credit Canada, and she was here to talk about debt after death.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, Gen Z financial activist, money mentor, and TikTok star Priceless Tay will be our guest. But first, Etsy, eBay, Poshmark, these are online marketplaces, and each of them have their own digital payment methods. Sandra Mayers from Adyen is here to talk about how these different payment models work and what they mean for consumers. I'm also the money columnist for CBC Radio, and that means that every Wednesday afternoon, I'm yakking away on the radio talking about topics related to you and your financial life. We can meet there too.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are so many ways to shop now. You could kick it old school and go to the mall, go to a physical store. You could shop online on a website. You can even shop in the metaverse. And there are many costs and benefits to this newfound simplicity. The main cost is it's just too easy to buy stuff. But certainly the benefit of convenience and simplicity and, you know, finding the best deals, all that. Innovation in the payments industry is only accelerating. There is just a ton going on. So we're going to look at this topic from the perspective of the consumer, you and me, not the industry, but you and me. And to do that, we're going to talk to Sander Myers. He is the country manager for Canada for Adyen, which is a global payments company. Welcome, Sander.
Thank you, Bruce. Looking forward to this conversation.
So I am deeply ambivalent when we have conversations about payments, because on the one hand, I see the benefits, right? The efficiency of paying with some sort of technology, the opportunity for small business to expand their markets. And then on the other side, when it is so easy for us to spend, it can be easy for us to overspend too. So I just state that off the top. But I want to ask you first, what are the biggest themes that you see underpinning the future of the payments industry in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, there's a few things, but one that obviously comes to mind is we just had the pandemic behind us, and the pandemic really made us realize that, well, as stores closed down, retailers had to shut their doors, shopping still had to go on, right? Yeah. So retailers really had to step up on their game when it comes to e-commerce transactions, or maybe even pick up at the closed store. And they really had to double down on innovation when it came to your e-commerce checkout flows or your flows where you do a pickup at the store. Mm-hmm. So one of the big trends I'm seeing is retailers really have to find a way to have the online experience and the in-store experience mimic the same vibe or the same ease of use, the same seamlessness. And for that, you really have to think about not two different companies that maybe have the same brand, but it really has to be one company that recognizes this consumer. So you can do proper consumer flows like return in store, or if you're in the store and it doesn't fit your color, you can easily make an online transaction and get the stuff delivered to your house, and basically recognize the shopper wherever the shopper decides to go. We call that unified commerce, which is a term that you'll hear more often too. That's one of the key themes, I would say, is what a lot of retailers are talking about, because consumers want it. They don't want a different experience, whether they go in store or online. It needs to feel the same way.
We want it in some ways because it's so convenient. Where it is uncomfortable is when we get surprised that a company recognizes us in a different context, and we put together, oh wait, they've been following me online for days, which is why I'm getting served up this crazy ad. What are the downsides of unified commerce, and in particular, how consumers feel about retailers having this much data available to them?
Yeah, I mean, you basically described the feeling of unease, right? Are they following me around? Yes or no? I think it's every brand's own decision to have consumers opt in or opt out to that and be very careful with what they do with it. It shouldn't be only used as an incentive to have people buy more, as you started your opened the conversation with. It should be more of a way to do things that consumers are already doing in an easier, faster way. I think it quickly becomes scary if you only get pushed more ads or more stuff in your face, whether you're in store or online. But that is a retailer's decision. The data is protected. Every payment provider in this industry has really stringent rules on how to protect the data. And every consumer can opt in to have their data used or not.
I know very little about this space, but I have a hypothesis that the work on getting to people to buy is somewhat easier than enabling them to return. And I say that based on my own experience. It's very, very easy to get something shipped to my house. Boy, it can be difficult if it doesn't fit or doesn't work. Where are the advances coming in terms of that circular transaction that includes those of us who sometimes need to return something to the place we bought it?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in that space. And to be honest, I can only really speak to the payment side of this. And if I look at the advances in the payment side, if a retailer really has the same technology built for the e-commerce and the in-store experience, there is really nothing, no problem, no manual work needed for that retailer. If you come in and you say, hey, I don't fit these jeans, they will say, oh, I saw you bought them online. We have the same one in store. Click, click, done. Here's your money back, and here's your new store. So on the payment side, it really the advances are here that people are being recognized on their payments data, which means less manual work and a speedier consumer experience.
It used to be that the economies of scale really served the massive retailers like Amazon, for example. How are smaller retailers doing in terms of catching up? Like we've talked about Etsy and Poshmark and, you know, ones that aren't shipping tens of thousands of packages every single minute. Have they been able to make inroads? Is their experience similar these days?
Well, what smaller retailers or sub-merchants or mom and dad shops are doing is leveraging platforms much more and more. And some are brands by itself, like Amazon or eBay, and some are more invisible platforms in the background. So a big customer group of ours are these platforms, and they really basically built out all the payment technology. So you can pay in whatever payment method you like. You can get paid in a faster term, in the terms you'd like. You can basically organize your store or all the stuff you're selling in your store in a way that's been pre-built. So smaller merchants are really using platforms to be fast and nimble when it comes to payments technology or banking capabilities. Because if you're a small mom and dad shop and you're only selling pumpkins during Halloween, it's going to be really hard to build a tech stack that can compete with the big guys. So you see more and more that smaller merchants are using platforms to have the same competencies as the big ones.
What are the economics that drive innovation in payments? Like, how does a company like yours or any of the players in the ecosystem, how do they make more money by improving their technology?
No, I love that. I love that question. End of the day, it's about loyalty with your shoppers. So every time you imagine if you try to buy something and it doesn't work, you're probably not going back to that store, right?
Ever. I may pick it outside with a sign and tell everybody I know they're terrible people.
Don't go in there. So that's number one, right? If it just really works and it's seamless, people will be coming back. So you're not going to lose stuff, or you're going to have more loyalty. So that's one key driver. Another one is, if you're not letting people pay with the payment methods they want to be using, they're also not going to come in your store. I mean, we have tons of Asian people in Canada. If they can't pay with WeChat Pay or Union Pay or Alipay, it probably will be less triggered to pay. So really giving consumers the opportunity to pay as they want to pay. That is a big driver for them, so you can reach more consumers. And another thing is, but that's more industry-wide, is if you've got tons of different systems running asynchronously, and you bolt one IT system up to another IT system, it becomes like a big beast that you can't control anymore. And it costs a lot of money to keep that working, keep that innovating into new customer experiences. So really simplifying your technology will end of the day save you money and give you less cost.
Every grocery store I go to has self-checkout. It's super annoying. If I have any more than two items, I'll wait in line for a cashier because I don't want to do it. When will we see self-checkout in every single retail outlet out there? Like, I'm surprised that clothing retailers don't offer that as an option.
Yeah. I mean, some do, actually. There are stores in Europe. So I came to Canada almost a year ago, and before that I was in Europe. And there were stores where you just, Decathlon and Uniqlo were doing it in Europe, where you just throw your clothes into a bucket and you just pay at the terminal. So it is already happening. If you go to the Blue Jays nowadays, you can go into the new area. There's a store that is completely self-service. You just tap your credit card when you walk in. You take your drinks or your snacks or whatever, and you just walk out. So it's already happening. Your question is, how fast will everyone be doing it? It's hard to predict. I'd say you'll be seeing more and more of it in the coming 5 years. Whether it be standard, let's find out. A lot of big companies have invested a lot in their old technology, and they just want to wait until it actually breaks down until they invest in new stuff. Well, I think retailers, the ones that go into the new flows, will be getting more customers at the end of the day.
just before we go here, what is your one bold prediction for the future that honestly, truth be told, you say it's like a 50-50, like it's not something you'd bet your house on, but what is one bold prediction you've got for the payment sector? Could be in Canada, could be globally.
I would say it's a global one. So Canada's absolutely part of this one. I would say you don't see any terminals anymore. Right, so the things you put your card in or you tap your card on, I think they can disappear. Every person has a cell phone in their pocket, so why not just use the payments on that cell phone that is already in every store clerk's pocket, or just walk out of the store without tapping something? I think the technologies are already there. Apple is doing tap to pay on phones. There's other companies that are pretty far ahead. I think there's a future where we don't see terminals anymore, anywhere.
Interesting. We will be watching. Sander, thank you for making the time to speak to us today.
Thank you, and hope to speak again.
Take care. Sander Myers, bye. Canada's country manager for Adyen, a payments company. And we were talking about big themes in the payments industry in Canada and what is to come. Coming up, Priceless Tay. Her real name is Taylor Price, and she has over 1 million followers on TikTok. She's going to be here to talk about her own personal finance journey and how she teaches Gen Z about financial literacy. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, whether you're a Gen Z, a millennial, a Gen X, a boomer, a traditionalist, you can sign up for our newsletter. Go to moolala.ca. I update the things that we have covered here on this radio show on SiriusXM, plus CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg. Just go to moolala.ca and add your email address. We won't do anything with it other than send you a newsletter once a month.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Yeah. We have heard this about 14,000 times from people. Financial education should be taught in school. It's not taught enough in school. How are we going to engage the next generation in financial literacy? Well, one place it is being taught is on social media, on TikTok. Our next guest has, what, like 1 million followers on TikTok? And she is doing her very best to give Gen Z something to think about when it comes to their money. Taylor Price is known as Priceless Tay. She joins us now from Woodstock, New York, to talk about financial literacy and what she's trying to do to shake things up for this new generation. Hello, Taylor.
Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
I am great. Clearly, you and I have one very important thing in common, and that is we want to make personal finance fun. We want to engage people who kind of roll their eyes when they think about this topic. What was your moment? What was the moment when you said, oh, wait, I have something to say here, and I'm going to go about say it?
Oof. Yeah, that is a great question. So I started off college. I actually graduated with a finance degree, but prior to that, I was pre-med. And when I made that transition, I knew absolutely nothing about personal finance. And I asked my guidance counselor, hey, did I miss a few gen eds here?
Right.
I didn't know.
Was I sick that day?
Right. Was I sick? Was I supposed to learn how to pay my taxes like in high school or something like that? Because I just turned 18 and I think that I'm 18 now and I might have to start paying taxes. Mm. She goes, oh, no, you didn't miss anything. You're like right where you're supposed to be. And I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely not feeling that way at all. And so doing the research back then, only 6 out of 50 states at that time required a personal finance course for testing. And now it's 7 out of 50 states, with Florida being the most recent one. But oh boy, that is where my anger, I guess, towards our United States education system came to be. And so as an angry Gen Zer, I started a blog, which then led to Instagram, YouTube, and now TikTok.
What is the first video? Do you remember the very, very first video that you posted? I'm assuming it was on Instagram because that on YouTube because that platform's been around the longest.
I actually wanted to start posting YouTube videos way long ago. I did video game streaming and things like that. So I don't recollect exactly the first ever YouTube video.
Right. Quite honestly. I'm sure we could find it, but suffice it to say, it led to big things. What have you noticed about posting on TikTok and learning that as a platform? It's not the same as posting on YouTube.
Oh, no, definitely not. First off, TikTok has a much broader audience in the sense that videos can go viral very, very quickly. And one thing that I really noticed with TikTok was that my message spread like wildfire globally when it comes to financial literacy, because when I first started to talk about this topic, I didn't have really many followers on YouTube or Instagram. But when I started talking about it on TikTok, boom, people from the UK, people from the Philippines were like, yeah, in our country, they're not really taught financial literacy either. This is a problem that I'm facing. Money is a taboo topic in my country too. I love what you're doing about talking about it openly.
What guides your thinking on the types of posts you believe will resonate and or you believe your audience needs to hear, even if you don't think they're going to resonate?
Oh, that's a great question, too. It's definitely self-fulfilling in that my priceless community, I call them priceless peeps. They give me questions into what they might be struggling with in their current life or how to grow their money tree. And so the community asks, I provide the answers on top of things that I want to talk about. For example, I cannot stand being in the salon, spending $100 on nails that will only last me 3 weeks. Like I call a series Beauty on a Budget, where I want to get my press on nails for $5 at Five Below, put them on and then talk about it in a video. So although somebody might not ask for that, I'm throwing in a little bit of my personality in some of my videos.
Love it. And I'm sure you've got great nails. I'm sure they're fantastic. Yeah. We can't see them here, but I'm sure they're great. There is a certain amount of misinformation on the social media platforms, as there is on any topic that you can possibly imagine, because it's people without PhDs in, you know, car repair or medical science or whatever it is, where it's crowdsourcing. So of course there would be. How do you deal with that yourself? You've got a finance background. Clearly you spent tons of time thinking of this, and you wouldn't want to be lumped in with a group of folks who don't have the cred on these platforms.
That's right. Do your own due diligence. I like to say that social media is a great ignition for those who don't know what a Roth IRA is. Now, if you've heard about it online, okay, let me take a look at some credible sources or some books that have lasted for however many years that topic has existed for. Roth IRAs are only like pretty recent, within the past few decades. But taking a look at those older, credible sources from books, blogs, news outlets. If Fortune's talking about somebody, well, they probably have some sort of credibility within where they're talking about. And so actually, when I first started, that was one of the big things for me, because I was only 18, 19 talking about this topic. Well, what provides you with credibility? Okay, I got my bachelor's degree in finance at 20. So we can start from there. Mm-hmm. And then moving along and actually looking at the numbers and habits, because I am very open about how I manage my finances online too.
I am a Gen Xer, but parent to a 13-year-old. And I think two of the challenges that my kid has that I didn't have is virtually unlimited things to want. Like there's just so many things that you could want now, and a much, much bigger access to consumer credit, not for a 13-year-old, but for a young person, certainly. How do you address those two differences for Gen Zers?
Well, in regards to building credit scores, what you're asking for?
No, I mean, just so much easier to get credit. I mean, when I was a kid, I'm going to sound like I'm 100, but I had to go to the bank on Friday before 2 because the bank would be shut at 2 and I would have no money for the weekend if I didn't get cash out in advance. Now, everybody's got a debit card. You can get money anytime, as long as it's in your bank, you can get it any time of the day or night. And if you've got a credit card, it doesn't matter if you don't have it because the credit card company will loan it to you at an exorbitant rate. So the challenge for younger folks is, I think, quite different than for the next generation or two up.
I see. I understand what you're saying. Yeah. In terms of wanting to spend without money you do not have, I do think that a lot of fintech apps, which are those apps on your phone that you can download to get online banking or check your credit score or credit cards, they do have restrictions set in place where you can place a notification on your phone where my bank balance is $100. Make sure to notify me when it's $50 or when I reach a certain credit limit that I can set on my app, it will notify me and say, no more spending. You don't have that money, no more spending. And so I do think that they do a great job, and it just comes a matter of moderation. I mean, we talk about it in every single other aspect of life, like food and desserts. Oh, don't eat, don't drink a milkshake every single day. Same thing when it comes to credit and your finances. If the money's not there, try not to spend it.
You have a program called Finesse, and you're working on helping people, quote, grow their money tree. How does that work?
I love it. My mom told me growing up, money doesn't grow on trees, Taylor. And so after thinking about it, and I had probably a decade to really sit on this one, I go, Mom, you might be right, like really literally, but conceptually, I think I got it here. You have your roots as your emergency fund, your savings account. So when a storm comes by, such as you get into a car accident or you get laid off from your job, that money tree will stay rooted in the ground and you will have a peace of mind knowing that you got 3, 6, 9 months of living expenses to make sure that you are okay and you don't have to go in debt. Then we grow up our money tree with our trunk, which is our primary source of income. Trees have bark, and that bark helps protect trees. In finance or the money tree method, I like to consider this as insurance. Insurance can be something that can protect us if we get into a car accident, or if, let's say, if we're in an apartment, there's a flood or there's a fire, our assets or things within our house can be protected. Then we begin to grow our money tree even further with different branches. These branches can be considered such as turning your side hustle into a full-blown business. It's highly risky. Investing can be highly risky. It's not guaranteed money. When you think about trees, those branches can fall down. And so those are the things, though, that can really build this money leave type self-fulfilling tree where it's the difference between passive income versus active income, income that you actively have to work for, or that passive income where it's make money when you sleep. And then honestly, if you think about it, well, first, if you have debt, you can think of insect enemies or termites that are eating away at your financial core that will just eat away at your savings and anything else, which I like to think is a good representation. And then you really have the environment in which your tree lives in. Of course, we all know that there's different types of trees out there in the environment. But if you think about it financially, we're talking about the economy in which we're in right now. Are we in a bull market or a strong market? Or are we in a bear market or a recession? So that's the money tree method. And I do believe, Mom, sorry, you're wrong on this one.
You know what? I'm siding with you. I think it is a really, really powerful metaphor. And I really appreciate you making the time to be with us to talk about it today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Priceless Tay, also known as Taylor Price, is a Gen Z financial activist, money mentor, educator. She joined us to talk about how to engage this generation in financial literacy. That is our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada, longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you would like to reach us for any reason, comments, questions, story ideas, feedback, thoughts on the grow your money tree metaphor, send us a note at ask@moolala.ca. You can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca, subscribe to the podcast on any of the platforms you visit, and while you're there, leave us a review. On social media, I'm no Taylor Price, but I am on Twitter at Bruce Celery. On Facebook, I'm Bruce Celery, Moolala. I'm not on Instagram. I'm barely on TikTok. I'm a terrible person, but I'm trying. Thanks for listening and have a great day.